Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Support Troops, Behind the Scenes of the Air War in Vietnam, by William Munger. Narrated by Jim Siebert. Prologue. I was sitting in a right-side window seat on an American Airlines flight from Chicago's O'Hare Field to San Francisco International. We were in the boarding process. There was the usual tangle of people finding their seats, stowing bags in the overhead bins, moving aside to let someone pass, and flight attendants doing their best to manage the chaos. It was 8:30 a.m. on December 22, 1967. Cold and overcast with light flurries in the air, as I watched the baggage handlers outside my little window pitching suitcases onto the conveyor belt feeding the belly of this Boeing 727. Wearing my Air Force blues on the first leg of my journey to Southeast Asia, I pondered the logic that required me to wear my dress uniform to travel to a tropical war zone. The next time I would wear this uniform would be on my return trip home at the end of a one-year tour of duty. Having just said a gut-wrenching goodbye to my wife of less than a year, I thought about our first wedding anniversary coming up in just 2 weeks. Digging through the seat pocket in front of me, I was desperately looking for something to distract me from my misery. We had known for almost a year that this deployment was inevitable, but that didn't make it any easier now that it was here. After boot camp at Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio, I had been assigned to Electronics Technical School at Lowry Air Force Base in Denver, Colorado, to learn basic electronics, and then the advanced fire control system specific to the F-105 fighter bomber. When I first saw my orders and saw the term fire control, I thought to myself, wait a minute, I don't recall signing up to be a fireman. I soon learned that fire control meant the systems that controlled the firing of weapons and the dropping of bombs. This included the radar, bombing computer, and the gun sight that all worked in unison to deliver bombs, missiles, and 20-millimeter cannon fire accurately to their targets. Mary Jane and I got married in early January, just 5 weeks before my graduation from technical school. We rented a small apartment just off base, and had a wonderful few weeks together exploring the Rockies on weekends while waiting for my next set of orders. There were very few options in my specialty. I could be assigned to McConnell Air Force Base in Wichita, Kansas, Nellis Air Force Base in Las Vegas, Tockley RTAFB, Royal Thai Air Force Base, or Korat RTAFB, both in Thailand. These were currently the only active F-105 bases in the world. Holding our breath, we waited for the orders, hoping for one of the two stateside assignments. When they came down, we rejoiced, as I was assigned to the 23rd Tactical Fighter Wing at McConnell Air Force Base in Wichita. After graduation from tech school in mid-February of 1967, we packed our few belongings into a small U-Haul trailer, hitched to my air-cooled 1966 Corvair, and struck out across the Great Plains, headed east into Kansas. Having had several semesters of college, I really didn't have any firm idea of what I wanted to do with my life. I was just going through the motions and wasting my parents' money, so I took a semester off to work and take flying lessons. I'd been in love with airplanes and flying since I was a little kid. That was all it took in early 1966 for Uncle Sam to come calling. With the Vietnam War heating up, the military needed bodies and lots of them. When I got my draft notice, I decided to make the most of it and enlist in the Air Force to learn something useful, rather than allowing myself to be drafted into an infantry unit in the Army. It meant a 4-year commitment, but I really wanted to work on or around airplanes and learn a new skill in the process. I pondered these thoughts as I sat there waiting for final boarding and pushback from the gate. My orders were to report to Travis Air Force Base near San Francisco for a military contract flight this evening which would eventually terminate at Don Mueang Airport in Bangkok, Thailand. Only the U.S. Department of Defense, in its infinite wisdom, thought it prudent to send me on my way 3 days before Christmas. I was just flipping through the pages of the in-flight magazine, paying little attention, when a single word caught my eye. The word was Chanticleer. I had been to the Chanticleer Inn in Eagle River, Wisconsin, one summer when I was in sixth grade. The owners, the Allwards, used to be our neighbors in suburban Chicago when I was a little kid and were good friends of my parents. They had bought the rundown resort back in the 50s and worked hard to bring it to life. This article gave a very thorough history of the family and their success in building it into a thriving business. I had known their three kids, all of whom were now involved in the resort's everyday operations. It made for a fascinating read, but served only to heighten my inner loneliness as I sat amongst a plane full of passengers all bound for San Francisco, likely for vacation, to visit family for Christmas, or to go home. Every single one of them had a story to tell. This one is mine. Chapter 1. After the tug pushed us back from the gate and disconnected, we began to roll along O'Hare's maze of taxiways, finally falling into a line of planes, all dutifully waiting their turn to speed down the runway, taking flight to destinations all over the globe. After a half hour of moving, then stopping, then moving again down the taxiway, we finally turned onto the runway and began our takeoff roll, wheels rumbling across the concrete expansion joints until we began to fly. Once airborne, I could hear the landing gear retracting with a series of thumps. Then we began a smooth climb to 34,000 feet headed west. Chin in hand, I watched out the window as the ground disappeared and we climbed into the gray overcast, ultimately breaking out on top into bright sunshine a few minutes later. My gloomy mood improved somewhat as the sun shone through the cabin windows, and a flight attendant came down the aisle with the coffee cart. "Sir, would you like coffee or juice?" she asked pleasantly as the cart reached our row. "Yes, ma'am, coffee with cream and sugar, please," I replied while opening my tray table. As she handed me the cup with a sugar packet, a creamer, and a plastic spoon, she looked at my seatmate and inquired, "You, sir?" "Coffee, black," he replied from the middle seat. He appeared to be in his 50s, stocky, short, graying hair, wearing glasses, dark slacks, and a gray cardigan sweater. We hadn't spoken yet, but it was apparent from overhearing their pre-flight conversation that his wife was sitting next to him in the aisle seat, and they were on their way to spend Christmas with their daughter in San Jose. She asked for coffee with cream. "So where are you headed?" he asked, finally breaking the ice. "Thailand," I replied, while holding out my hand, adding, "I'm Bill." Shaking my hand, he replied, "I'm Jack. This is my wife, Joan. We're on our way to spend Christmas with our daughter and son-in-law. They live in San Jose." "Good for you. Do you live in Chicago?" I asked. "Waukegan, actually," he replied. "Well, nice area. I'm from LaGrange." "What do you do in the Air Force?" he asked. "I'm a fire control tech on the F-105. There are two F-105 bases in Thailand, one in Tak Li and the other in Korat. I'm headed for Tak Li." "Is this your first time overseas?" he asked. "Yes, sir, it is," I replied. "Good of them to send you on your way just 3 days before Christmas," said Jack. Then Joan chimed in, saying, "That's just awful. Why do they do that?" "There are no holidays on a military calendar, I guess," I replied. Over the next hour or so, I learned that Jack and Joan were originally from the Bay Area and had moved to Chicago 7 years earlier because of his job as a construction supervisor and program manager for a commercial developer. They had a multitude of projects going on all around the Chicago area. They had just one child, their daughter, who had been married for 5 years to a wonderful guy who worked for the city of San Jose as an accountant. They had a 2-year-old grandson, and were excited to see him because it would be the first Christmas that he would have any inkling about the magic of Santa. I asked Jack how long it would take to get from San Francisco International to Travis Air Force Base. He said it would probably be a couple of hours by bus. Travis was just about halfway between San Francisco and Sacramento. He asked me what time my flight left Travis. I told him I had no idea, and that my orders were simply to report to Travis Air Force Base no later than 6 p.m. PST on December 22nd, and then to Tok Lee on December 26th, where I'd be assigned to the 355th Ames, Armament and Electronics Maintenance Squadron. Crossing a multitude of time zones, plus the international dateline, I really had no idea how long all of this would take, or what time, or even what day it would be when I arrived in Bangkok. My only immediate concern was arriving at Travis before 6 p.m. The rest would somehow take care of itself. Jack told me he'd been in the Navy in World War II as a crewman on a Liberty-class supply ship in the Pacific Theater. Fortunately, he said, he'd never been shot at, and his ship had not been targeted by torpedoes, although that had been a constant concern. He asked me about the F-105s, assuming that the F meant fighter. I told him that the F-105 was actually a fighter-bomber, having been designed in the early 50s during the Cold War with the Soviet Union. It originally had only one mission, to deliver a single nuclear bomb in any kind of weather, using its terrain avoidance radar and bombing computer. The simple idea was to fly low level at supersonic speed toward the target, then pull up and release the bomb, which would follow a trajectory similar to pitching a softball underhand. The aircraft would continue to pull up vertically, then go inverted, headed directly back from where it came, finally rolling right side up, thus escaping the area before the bomb detonated. The airplane was very big and very fast. While the idea was simple, its successful execution was anything but. It relied on primitive analog computer technology. Needless to say, the F-105 was never used for its originally intended purpose. Our military discussion waned, and somewhere west of the Mississippi River, the overcast thinned, then disappeared altogether, and I could see the ground again. It was difficult to gauge exactly where we were because the landscape was so brown and desolate. There was no snow on the ground, and I guessed we were somewhere over the plains of western Kansas or eastern Colorado. Just 10 months earlier, Mary Jane and I had driven across this barren yet beautiful landscape, giddy that we were getting another year or so together before I would have to deploy. We'd made the most of our time together in Wichita. We rented a single-bedroom apartment off base, paying considerably more than we could afford. Even with a promotion to Airman Second Class, E3, a marriage allowance, and Mary Jane working at a local dress store, we could barely make ends meet, but we really didn't care. We were together, and that's all that mattered. When I was off duty, we explored Wichita and found it to be an interesting mix of aviation, culture, and Wild West. It was headquarters to Cessna Aircraft Company, Beech Aircraft Company, Lear Aviation, as well as a huge Boeing facility based on the grounds of McConnell that did a lot of top-secret modifications to the B-52 bomber. It was home to Wichita State University and had a wonderful art museum as well. There was also Cowtown, with Old West gunfight reenactments. You didn't have to venture far beyond the city limits to find yourself in the wide open spaces. And there was wind. Lots of wind. It seemed as if it rolled over the Rockies, then headed east across the Great Plains with nothing to stop it or even slow it down. Native Kansans took a lot of pride in their state. The Arkansas River flows through downtown Wichita, but they proudly called it the Arkansas River. We'd heard that one time, true or not, the Kansas state legislature had declared the Nebraska state bird, the western meadowlark, to be a pest. The Nebraska state legislature countered by declaring the Kansas state flower, the sunflower, to be a noxious weed. we found it all to be quite amusing. We embraced our time in Kansas, all the while dreading my next set of orders. Rumors were that we could expect orders to Southeast Asia anywhere from 6 to 12 months after arriving. The work at McConnell was all business. Most of the pilots were transitioning from other aircraft into the F-105 and were being trained by pilots who had somehow survived 100 missions flying combat sorties over North Vietnam before being rotated back to the States to pass on their hard-earned knowledge. Similarly, new techs like me, fresh out of tech schools, were getting crucial on-the-job training to maintain and repair F-105s. Besides the fire control, there were troops trained in other systems like Doppler radar, communications, weapons, instruments, and engines also getting their hands dirty on the real thing. Before arriving at McConnell, I had never even seen a real F-105. I'd seen pictures and training films, but none of that prepared me for my first day on the job, walking out onto the flight line and seeing how big and badass this airplane really was. All of that was behind me now, and I was headed to Tak Lee to put that training to good use on airplanes that pilots were relying on to get them to their assigned targets, deliver their ordnance, and then get them safely back to base. I could see the snow-covered Rockies ahead as we approached central Colorado. We had a little over an hour and a half to go before landing in San Francisco. I opened my small carry-on and found a pen and stationery and began writing the first of hundreds of letters I would write to Mary Jane over the next year or so. It helped emotionally to put pen to paper. I told her I was approaching the Rockies, but couldn't tell if we'd be crossing near Denver or not. I would call her when I got to San Francisco, and once again from Travis, but assumed that once I boarded that contract flight to Bangkok, we would not be able to speak to each other again for a year. Our communications would be all via letters. I assumed one couldn't just find a phone in the middle of Thailand and make a call back to the U.S. If you could, I had no idea how that would work or how much it would cost. There was no internet in those days, no email, texting, or FaceTime. Communication was primitive by today's standards. After finishing and addressing the letter, I put my pen and tablet away and tried to nap. I hadn't slept well last night and was emotionally exhausted, but try as I might, sleep eluded me, and I simply stared out the window as we crossed the snow-covered Rocky Mountains. I imagined families gathering for Christmas in Aspen and Vail, and began to feel sorry for myself again, as I remembered Mary Jane and I spending a wonderful weekend in Aspen about 11 months ago. We called it our honeymoon, and our parents had chipped in the cash to make it happen. Trying to shake it off, I went back to the in-flight magazine looking for the crossword puzzle. Someone on a previous flight had completed about half of it, so I set about trying to fill in the rest. It was a welcome distraction. An hour or so later, we began a slow descent combined with gentle turns as air traffic control worked us into the crowded airspace of the Bay Area and got us lined up for landing to the southwest. Out my window, as we descended over the bay, I could see Oakland and San Francisco with the Golden Gate Bridge in the distance. I'd only been to California once before, several months earlier when our squadron spent 2 weeks on temporary duty, TDY, in the high desert near Victorville at George Air Force Base, northeast of Los Angeles. Pilots were there to practice live fire exercises on the bombing ranges, and we were there to repair and maintain the aircraft, so everyone got a small taste of what it would be like under wartime conditions in Thailand. As we touched down and taxied to our assigned gate, I gathered my few items and put them back into my carry-on. The flight attendant urged us to keep our seat belts fastened until we arrived at the gate and the pilot shut down the engines and turned off the fastened seatbelt sign. She announced that the local time was 11:35 a.m. I set my watch to Pacific time and mentally calculated that I would need to be on a bus no later than 3 p.m. to allow plenty of time to get to Travis before 6 p.m., so there was no need to hurry. Once we parked at the gate and the engines were winding down, everyone in the aisle seat seemed to stand in unison, opening overhead bins, gathering their belongings, and stretching their legs. Sitting on a plane for the last 4+ hours made everyone anxious to stretch and move and made me wonder how long the flight from Travis would take. I had no clue if an airplane could make it nonstop from California to Bangkok, or if we would make stops somewhere along the way. I fervently hoped we would make stops. After a few minutes, the line in the aisle began to move. As space opened up, Jack and Joan invited me to get up and deplane in front of them. I did so and thanked them for their thoughtfulness. When we reached the terminal concourse, we shook hands. I wished them a Merry Christmas, and they bid me farewell, wishing me luck and telling me to be safe. Then I made a beeline for a bank of payphones. Chapter 2. Picking up the handset and dialing O, I waited for the operator to come on, and when she answered, I told her I wanted to make a collect call to LaGrange, Illinois, and gave her the number. Mary Jane would be staying at her parents' house while I was away, and she answered on the second ring. The operator asked, "Will you accept long-distance charges from Bill Munger?" Mary Jane was saying, "Yes, yes, yes," before the operator could finish the question. The operator said, "Go ahead," and we both began talking at the same time, worried about each other, because we both had been such blubbering idiots this morning when my brother picked me up to take me to the airport. We assured each other that we were okay, and spent a few minutes relating the highlights and lowlights of the last few hours. I promised I would call again when I reached Travis Air Force Base before I boarded the flight that would literally take me to the other side of the planet. After hanging up, I began walking down the concourse towards the baggage claim. I had a single checked bag, called a B4 bag, which was a kind of soft-sided garment bag with a handle in the middle. It contained all the worldly belongings I was bringing with me, which really wasn't very much. I had 2 sets of fatigues, a couple of pairs of jeans and short-sleeve shirts, underwear, socks, toiletries, a deck of playing cards, and a jar of Planters peanuts. Once I arrived at my duty station, I would be issued proper fatigues for the climate, which would be jungle fatigues and jungle boots, not that I would ever set foot in an actual jungle. Taklī was about 15 degrees north of the equator and was considered tropical, as the seasonal temperatures would range from the 80s to about 110 degrees with 2 main seasons, dry and monsoon. Nearing the main terminal, I saw an information desk and stopped to ask where I might find the bus going to Travis Air Force Base. The guy at the desk told me where to find the bus stop and said they generally left every hour on the hour for Travis. Obviously, there was a lot of military traffic to justify hourly runs, so I didn't feel any need to rush. I had 6 more hours before I had to report. I didn't have much of an appetite this morning, so I had refused the meal that was offered on the flight from Chicago. But now I was starting to get hungry again. I found a rather simple restaurant where I could get a hamburger and a Coke before going to the baggage claim area. The terminal was extremely busy, with just 2 days to go before Christmas. Arriving down in the baggage claim area, the scene was chaotic, with people 3 deep around the conveyor belts watching the suitcases and wrapped gifts go by. Skycaps were loading their carts with luggage and packages, as harried passengers tried to keep track of their kids and belongings. Airline employees wearing Santa hats were trying their best to pair bags with their proper owners. Since I had dallied upstairs, I finally located my B4 bag in a long line of luggage that had been pulled from the belts to make room for more recent arrivals. Bag finally in hand, I slowly weaved my way through the throngs and headed outside to find some fresh air and elbow room. It was about 1:30 by now, and the weather was California perfect, sunny and in the low 70s. The scene outside was no less hectic, as taxis, buses, and cars all tried to gain some curb advantage with police officers blowing whistles and waving their arms to keep the lines of vehicles moving. There were a few hippies walking around with peace signs, but they weren't making much of a scene. None of them approached me. I don't handle that kind of chaos very well and was happy when I finally found my bus. The driver was outside on the curb with the big luggage storage doors open. He took my travel voucher and then stowed my bag. Stepping up onto the bus, I found it about half full with GIs of every service. Moving down the aisle, I found an empty seat by a window and sat, staring out at the hubbub and relishing the quiet inside. I wondered about all those folks out there. Were they stressed? Were they looking forward to their holidays and being with their families? No doubt some would be missing loved ones who had passed away since last Christmas. Others would be worried sick about sons or daughters who were already in Vietnam. I knew that Mary Jane and both of our families would be worrying about me, even though, unlike the pilots, I would be in very little danger from the actual war. With communication by mail lagging by about 7 to 10 days, we would always be getting our news about each other well after the fact, but there was nothing to be done about that. Soon, a tall kid about my age sat down next to me. He introduced himself as Ed Connolly, and he was an Army specialist trained as a vet assistant and dog handler, and was headed for Long Binh, a huge logistics base in South Vietnam, northeast of Saigon. Ed and I struck up a conversation while we waited for the bus to leave. It turned out he was also a Midwesterner from the Chicago area, and we had grown up in very similar circumstances. He'd been married just 7 months before his deployment. About 15 minutes later, the bus driver climbed aboard, closed the doors, and the bus left the curb, slowly navigating through the throngs of cars, taxis, and buses leaving the airport. While we drove through commercial districts and dense neighborhoods heading for the freeway, it seemed very odd for a couple of kids from the Midwest to be seeing Christmas decorations along with flowering shrubbery and green grass. We both agreed that California just seemed a little weird. I've been there many times since that day, and it still seems a little weird to me. Ed told me he had 2 sisters, 1 older and 1 younger. I told him I had just 1 brother, about 3 years older than me, who was a Marine reservist in an artillery company. When the bus finally hit the freeway, we both took in the sights as we headed north into San Francisco, then onto the Oakland Bay Bridge into Oakland on the east side of San Francisco Bay, before heading northward again past Berkeley. We'd both heard of Berkeley on the news as being ground zero of the hippie peace movement, and we commented to each other that while we certainly didn't want to go to war, we felt an obligation to our country to serve when called upon. The reasons for this war were debated well above our pay grade. There were hundreds of thousands of us who had taken the oath and were simply answering the call. We were sons of what is now known as the Greatest Generation, and rightly so. World War II had literally been a global struggle for freedom. Had the Allied forces lost that war, there's no telling what civilization would look like today. It's estimated that a staggering 75 to 80 million people died in the deadliest war ever waged on Earth, half or more of which were civilians. By comparison, the Vietnam conflict was a mere skirmish, but a miserable and deadly one if you were there. As we continued northeast towards Travis, the landscape was beautiful, with hills covered in dormant brown grasses glowing golden in the late afternoon California sunshine. When we finally arrived at the base, Ed and I both pondered what lay ahead of us before we would see California again. After retrieving our bags, we were directed to a building where we needed to present our orders, and would then find out when our respective flights would leave and where we would need to be to board them. It was a model of military efficiency, meaning get in line, move very slowly, then when you reach the front of the line, have a clerk inspect your orders, check his manifests, hand you a ticket envelope with your flight number and a bag tag, and then say, "Next?" No unnecessary info or chit-chat was offered. Ed was behind me, and I waited until he had his ticket. He was leaving at 8:30.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?